Capacity. Well, it's over to the panel, basically, now, to make comments, put questions to each panel, kick us off in perhaps a discussion.
That's what you meant, wasn't it?
We could just move on to tea break now.
No. Well, we seem to have an unusually shy bunch this morning. This must be a first in the history of the Western Buddhist Order. I think perhaps Vishapani, or the vision that he's given us, has left us speechless, but probably not for very long. And just to try to bridge the gap, I'll add a comment. I found very interesting Vishapani's classification of the different approaches or models of transmission or for bringing Dharma to the West. It's been quite common among historians of religion looking at Buddhism in the West to talk about two approaches, what's often called the transplantation approach and the adaptation approach. And I think Vishapani's taken this distinction forward in a very interesting way in maintaining the metaphor, first of all, of first transplantation as one approach, and secondly, what he's called harvesting. And these, of course, are not completely mutually exclusive. I like to think of it as a continuum with two ends, and you can locate different instances of bringing Buddhism to the West at various points on that continuum. So on the one side, something that would be more purely adaptation, even to the point perhaps of being fundamentalistic. And on the other hand, something that's more adaptive. But I like Vishwakani's notion of understanding this as an instance of harvesting, of gleaning what is the most useful part of the crop for the present situation. One idea I've come across recently that I think could fit into this framework very usefully is a notion that's come out of, I think, political science originally, but it's being applied more and more to religious movements, particularly from the perspective of political science, so not exclusively. And that's an attempt to try to distinguish between fundamentalism, which of course in the modern context has a very negative context, especially with regard to authoritarian religious traditions. Fundamentalism on the one hand, and a much more secularized openness or adaptiveness on the other hand. And if we think of that continuum, it's very hard to know where to place Bhante's approach to the Buddha Dharma. And I think Vishapani gave us some very good ideas there. And adding to the metaphor, he talked about this as a seeding approach. So you have transplanting, you have harvesting, but then there's the idea of reseeding a whole new process. And the term that I've come across that I think could fit into Vishwakani's analysis very well is neo-traditionalism. It's traditionalist on the one hand in that it seeks to go back to the tradition, especially to founding principles of the tradition, but it's a neo-traditionalism specifically in that it's not fundamentalistic. It's a traditionalism that locates itself in the current context. So I just offer that up as another way to think about this seeding notion. And I think this is a term that's going to gain some currency, neo-traditionalism, among especially sociological observers of modern religious movements.
I just add something to that. I think that we sometimes find it hard, especially outside of FWBO contexts, to really know how to talk about the FWBO's approach. So that's one reason why I've been trying to think of different ways to express what we're about. And by contrast with other approaches is helpful. Saramati actually said at the start of the talk, I was going to talk about the sense in which we're non-sectarian Buddhists. In fact, as I wrote my talk, I didn't talk about that, but that's the same sort of set of thoughts. You know, how can we tell what can we say to ourselves, to people coming to our centres, and especially in a more sophisticated environment where people know about different kinds of Buddhism, how can we explain what is the FWBO's approach, or to other Buddhists, or in the media, or whatever it might be. So I found it useful to make this distinction, looking at what's happening within the Buddhist world, that we're clearly not like the people who are just bringing Buddhism to the West. Although I want to make a qualification to that notion of transplantation, to say that actually a lot of the transplanted Buddhisms are adapting in very interesting ways, which I'd really like to learn from. So we shouldn't regard those kinds of Buddhism as fixed in a kind of Asian mold. So in that sense, that the adapted, transplanted kind of distinction breaks down. But then I think often when we start to talk about how we're not like that, we talk about ourselves in terms of adaptation. We're the people who like the arts and friendship and this and that. And not that there's anything wrong with those things, but they don't quite get to the heart of Bhante's approach. And I'd say that this is a problem in our centres, that we people coming to our centres think, oh, well, Buddhists are all the same, but the FWBO, they're really good at sangha, they're really good at friendship, or they're into poetry or something like that, which they're not into down at the NKT Centre or at Rigpa. And that's all okay, and that may be true so far as it goes, but it doesn't really do justice to Bhante's thinking at all. So that's where we come to the idea of seeding, which fits in with that metaphor. Just as a way of trying to remind ourselves and to communicate to other people what we're really about. So I think that's a worthwhile endeavour, whether you like that particular image or not, that we need to keep on finding ways to tell ourselves who we are, or at least tell ourselves who Bhante is, what his teaching really represents as the context changes. So there's a little bit of background to that.
I wanted to pick up on the something you said about Joseph Goldstein talking about the divisions between Asian Buddhism collapsing as it comes west, as Buddhism comes west. And I think it's easy for us to be to see that as maybe possibly a weakness. There was a Radio 4 programme, do you know Beyond Belief, those of you who live in Britain, where they did a whole programme a couple of years ago on Western Buddhism. And I was Buddhist, the FWBO speaker, and the presenter said, come on, the FWBO has been described by one Theravadin monk as pick and mix Buddhism, you're just taking what you like. And I think that's completely unfair, because I think it is the condition of Buddhism in the West, actually, Western Buddhism. And it's absolutely inescapable, because it's the product of history. You can't deny the effect of the internet and population migration. It's the divisions or the different sections of Buddhism historically partly arise out of reaction to perceived dryness in previous, perceived overemphasis on one aspect in the previous development of Buddhism, but also they're part of geographical isolation. So obviously, as we get to hear more and more about different kinds of Buddhism, we're bound to start looking around and learn. So I think we shouldn't fall prey to anyone's assertion that this is a weakness. It's when you look around, you see that actually everybody's doing it to some extent. It's not just us.
The question is how you do it. And that's where I think Bante's contribution comes in. There's someone up there, I think, to say something.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. I was interested in the area of the talk that you signalled that didn't go into about the non-sectarian aspect emphasis of Bante's teaching, and I was mentally comparing it with another very good talk you gave at Amaloka last year, talking about handling the tension between the polemicism of Bante's emphasis and communicating within the context of that. And it seems to me that maybe we're at a junction, this is what I'm really interested in the panel's views on, in how to distill, come to our own balance of what is for each of us essential Bante teaching, when a big mind and a big heart has a plural range of impulses and a range of contexts, and we inherit those, they point in different directions.
Okay, just on the non-sectarian question, I think I did give the talk that on non-sectarianism. That's essentially, you know, our approach is a non-sectarian approach. I was trying to talk about essentially what that approach is. I just didn't use the language. And on this question of polemics and rhetoric and so on, I think, you know, I've been critical of the way in which Bante has sometimes expressed himself, and I found that sometimes unhelpful. And that isn't to disagree with the content or the substance of what he's saying. So what I was trying to emphasize in this talk was trying to come at it maybe in a slightly different set of terms. The point that Bante is making, I think we often don't like his polemical way of writing. I often don't like it, but I think it's a great shame if we lose the substance of his contribution in rejecting his way of speaking. I think that's more a matter of temperament than anything else. Maybe a fashion, that's what Spooty says. You know, that polemical way of talking's gone out of fashion. Nonetheless, I don't like it, and I don't think it's helpful. But, you know, it's Bante's choice. But I value what he is saying in its essence.
I'd like to just briefly add something as you... Why don't you come on up to the mic? I find myself, perhaps like Bishop Honig, becoming increasingly more careful or wary of the rhetoric of non-sectarianism, and I'd like to take it a step further. The problem I have with the term, accurate as it may be in one sense, is that first of all, it suggests that other Buddhists are somehow not as proper. You can't have non-sectarian without sectarian, and we're ascribing that or projecting that on to other traditions, and among ourselves, well, perhaps fine, but if we're going to be in any meaningful dialogue, I think we need to be very aware of the effect that that has. The other problem I have with it is that had a discussion with someone from another Buddhist tradition that's even more eclectic or more ecumenical or more non-sectarian than we are. And I suddenly found myself feeling, wait a minute, this is not just non-sectarianism, this is a sectarianism of non-sectarianism. And I think some people have perceived us in that way as well, have taken our rhetoric of being non-sectarian to be almost a cover for something that they may rightly or wrongly have perceived as being in fact quite sectarian. So if we can find another way to talk about it, whether Bante has more recently talked about ecumenical Buddhism, and of course the unity of Buddhism and what Buddhists have in common. That's a much more positive way to speak. And again, I particularly like Vishwakarni's contribution today, the idea of seeding Buddhism or reseeding traditional Buddhism in a new field, I think is a, it's a very useful metaphor.
Thank you, Vishwapani, for your talk. Something I've been pondering on myself recently is how one describes to people who visit our centres what we have in terms of lineage. I don't have a problem with that at all, but I just think I just would be interested in hearing the panel's thoughts on how one describes our lineage and how lineage relates, or descriptions of lineage relate to those three to the model. Because actually it is a bit of a hang-up for people. I've recently had a very good friend who got involved with the movement, asked to be a Mitra, had a bit of a reaction to being a Mitra, went to another tradition, and that tradition, people in that tradition were saying that Bali has no right to, no authority. And it's a lineage issue. And it seems to me that in a way the transplanted model, it's almost easier, if you like, to name your lineage. So I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say.
I remember a headline in an old, I think it was Golden Drum, "What's Your Lineage?" As in, "What's Your Line?" It's an old TV. There's a number of ways you can respond. I just want to say one thing, which is, the Kalama Sutta says, in the Kalama Sutta, Buddha says, do not go by lineage.
May I just say something about that? I'm more interested in the question, I think, than I am to answer it. One of the things I was struck by in what Vishwapani was saying was that he was, in some ways, I can't remember quite how you put it, but critical of how isolated we've been in the past. And I know that sort of your experience in the communications office, Vishwapani, your experience in the communications office, my experience in the liaison office, and we've been in quite a privileged position by FWBO standards of having quite a lot of dialogue with other traditions. And if I understood you, you were sort of saying that's a healthy dialogue that or something been developing in the last few years that you would welcome and encourage. But you were also saying that out of that dialogue comes an increased need for critical thinking. I think one of the things that's interesting for me is that very often the fact that we have a question like that, how do we stand in relationship to lineage, we're picking up an assumption, particularly from the Tibetan tradition, and I guess it's a Tibetan group that's raising that question in Manchester. And I think a lot of us don't have the experience to think critically enough to understand the embedded assumptions that we're looking at in a practice. And I suppose the sort of question for me is that we've got that the fact now that there is much more dialogue, the possibility for learning, for communication, set against what certainly has in the past been Bali's positive discouraging of people having too much dialogue. And I think the question for me is, how far is engagement with other traditions a healthy extension and clarification of our own experience, and how far do we end up bringing in assumptions without really realising it that start to confuse the clarity that we need for an intense engagement with and a clear communication of our own tradition? And I do want to, I'm tempted to try to answer it, but actually I would rather leave it as a question, I think. I think that the fact that you can have mitras, I would guess not a few ordinary members disturbed by a question like that, points to me for the need for a real conceptual clarity before critical engagement is even possible. So we'll leave it as a question. Would you like to answer that?
Could I just suggest, before we move on to a completely new comment or topic, I wonder if any of you, particularly those of you who have encountered this in your centers, have any comments or ideas about how to deal with this issue on the ground, so to speak.
The issue is really interesting, and I think a good description of Bhante's way, apart from the three Ratna approach, the three Jnana approach. And I do think that the lineage, to some extent, is described in the wreckage tree, and to some extent in the individual sadhana. And from there on, whichever person is not person, obviously, Buddha goes on the different lineages to the Shakyamuna Muni. So I was wondering how the panel thinks about the Triyana idea.
I'll say a little bit about this whole question, actually. I mean, the Triyana idea is embedded in Tibetan Buddhism, and it has its own way of looking at the Buddhist tradition. You know, Bhante in the 50s, his vihara was Triyana Vardhana Vihara, wasn't it? So that he saw himself for a period of his life as a Triyana Buddhist, in the sense of wanting to accept the whole Buddhist tradition. But he has subsequently developed, he's rejected that as his stance, because it implies that what comes last is best. And Subhuti writes about this in his book, Sangharsha, New Voice in the Buddhist Tradition. And I quoted, perhaps a little flippantly, that statement from the Kalama Sutta, because I just think once we start to get involved in the game of seeking authority in prior sources, we won't win it. I take the refuge tree as an image of sources of inspiration, but I don't think we can claim that those sources of inspiration are sources of authority in the way that would be understood, say, within a tantric lineage. So I think it's quite important to make that distinction. I think we should, and I think this is what Bhante does. He doesn't really claim authority to teach from anywhere, anyone, or anything, other than his own experience of practicing the Dharma and going for refuge to the Three Jewels, his own study and experience and practice. And I think we come back to the Kalama Sutta, try it out. When you know for yourselves that these things work, then follow them.
I found this whole morning very, very stimulating and very thought-provoking. And particularly the question of authority, because authority is seen sometimes as a negative value and sometimes as a positive value. And it rather depends on your interlocutor, depends who you're speaking to. Some people like authority, they like certainty. They like, and some people react against it. So when you're faced with someone who asks these sort of questions, what is your lineage? You have to know where you stand, it seems to me. You have to understand that actually nothing is transmitted. That you yourself, we ourselves, are the source of our own authority. Sparked off by Bhante, of course, and sparked off by, our relationships with all our brothers and sisters here. That's my view, and I don't know what your response is.
Okay, this is Sasana Ratna here. I've got a question which might actually relate a wee bit to Ashwajit's comment. I think that model of the seed is a good way of describing Bhante's teaching. But to me, it still leaves the question, what about us? What is our role in relation to that tree? Are we different fruits, the same fruit, whatever? I sometimes feel like a banana stuck on an apple tree. I think my concern is, it's about individual initiative. The way our movement is structured, as it seems to me, is we have the potential. I think the way our movement is structured, we have a better potential to take personal initiative, I think, compared to other Buddhist groups. And I'd like to think that that is a distinguishing feature of our movement. I'd like to be able to say to people that the FWO, perhaps amongst other things, that the FWO is a movement which encourages and accommodates personal initiative. But at the moment, I don't know if I can say that wholeheartedly, because I don't know if other people want that. I don't know if other people would agree that this is a virtue in itself, that this is something worthwhile, that we can accommodate and want to accommodate personal initiative. So I wonder if Bishop Pani or the rest of the panel have any comments on that?
I'd quite like to respond to that. I'm aware of, in a way, I'm sitting up here with different hats on. There's me as a practitioner, there's me as a member of the Western Buddhist Order, there's me as a student of my teacher, and I'm aware as well, you know, of the responsibility as part of the ordination training for passing on the teaching of my teacher. And I wanted to go back to the Kalama Sutta. Actually, I think in the Kalama Sutta, if I remember it rightly, the Buddha gives you this long demolishing job of any external authority, brings you back to your own experience, but then puts your own experience in dialogue with the wise. And to me, you know, like Bishop Bani used in his own talk about his originality and realising how shaped it had been by the influences of his teachers. And one of the things that I've been concerned about in our teaching recently, particularly around meditation teaching in particular, has been a tendency to polarise and to set up as oppositions things that I think actually are better seen as compliments. And personally, I would really strongly encourage individual initiative. Like, I think if we don't, as order members, feel that we're free to practice, to look at your own experience, and to communicate out that experience, the whole thing's going to sill up and bring to a halt. It has to come out of a real live experience. On the other hand, I think I'm certainly feeling very strongly, I've got a responsibility to pass on what my teacher taught me. I think otherwise we're going to get this sort of Chinese whispers version of the people that I teach and the people that you teach can no longer speak to each other. But I think we've got a responsibility to be in dialogue. I think we've got a responsibility to be receptive to our teachers, which doesn't mean uncritical in relation to our teachers. But I think rather than trying to set up individual initiative as opposed to some sort of collective cabinet responsibility, I think it's much more accurate to see it as a dialogue. You've got your own experience, which is undeniable. You know what works for you. You've got your own, you know, organic, spontaneous wish to pass that experience on. That's the life of what makes it a Dharma tradition. On the other hand, that experience has to come into relationship or to the experience of our teachers, and particularly where there's a difference. I think we've got a real responsibility just to sit with that difference and not to try to sort of bang this thing about the premature synthesis. Go too quickly, go to my teacher says so, it must be true, and deny your own experience. On the other hand, don't get so uppity that your own experience becomes the measure of your Dharma practice. Your experience embedded in a communication of a tradition. I think that dialogue is absolutely crucial between ourselves, between us and our teachers, and between us and the people that we teach. If we're going to be in order, that element of our experience and communication is crucial.
I agree with all that. Give me a minute. I just thought I'd tell you a story that came to my mind actually when I was listening to Sasanaratna, which anecdote really, which was when I was travelling with Bhante in 93 in the States, when Saramati was ordained on that trip. And we were doing retreats in various retreat centres belonging to other movements. So we would invite the psyche for these other movements, would be kind of present, would be around while we were doing the retreat. And they were quite often, people were quite surprised that Bhante didn't do any teaching. He just left it to us, to the older members, to do the teaching. And quite a lot of people found that very surprising. And I think Bhante's always had remarkable confidence in allowing us to go our own way in some ways. But the really funny thing for me is that in each of these places, Bhante did do something. But what he did was read poetry, which I just thought was quite interesting. You know, so people, we would invite people from these other sanghas to come and join us for the night that our great teacher was going to be sharing something. And people would come along expecting some great teaching, and Bhante would stand up and read poems. I just thought that was very interesting. That's all I've got to say. Yeah, his own poems. Sorry, no, he wasn't reading Walt Whitman or anything. It was his own poems. And he knew what some of us thought about that. So every time he would start, he would come in and say, yes, another poetry reading by Bhante.
Just a couple of brief points. One was, I think, the triple gem way. I find saying the three jewels Buddhism is a little bit lumpy. It's something like the triple gem way, perhaps. With regards to the other botanical simile, I was reading the other day that apparently there was an English gentleman in South America, and he was having dinner with a viceroy when he noticed some strange seeds on the table. So he grabbed five of these seeds. He was a plant collector. And he brought the seeds back, and they were planted and became monkey puzzles. And in fact, now there's more monkey puzzles in Western Europe than there are in the place of origination, which is Chile. And in fact, just recently in Chile, they've had to declare the monkey puzzle a national monument because they're afraid they're going to lose it. And now it seems to me that this simile, an important point, but I think with this simile, we don't just, if you just say, oh, we're this special scene, we might seem like a cult. We're that special scene. I think actually we have to be very indebted to the plant collectors, because actually they transplanted Buddhism here so that Bhante could come across the Dharma Sutra. So in fact, we do have our roots in the plant collectors. And then nextly, the seeds that got planted, well, they played their part. But I think coming to the harvesters, I think we need to realise that shopping around, which harvesting is very important. Now, a lot of us probably wouldn't be here if we hadn't gone harvesting. So we shouldn't look down on harvesting. And not to be rude, I very much appreciate your talk. I'm just making the point that harvesting is very positive. And people like Harvest will after a while come to realise that you have to go deep. You have to find a seed that really suits you. And then you actually drill deeper to the depths. So all that's what I'm getting is, I think actually our hierarchy would appreciate all aspects, the collector and the planter and the shepherd, which harvesting is. So that's my general sort of comment.